FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. Today is March 22nd, 2017. Well, we've now had a few months of Trump. Picture is starting to get perhaps a little bit clearer, perhaps not. What's going to happen with inflation, asset prices, the budget, and interest rates? Well, we've got Jordan Goodman on with us now, moneyanswers.com. Jordan, welcome back.
Great to be with you again, Kerry.
As always. So, the picture, maybe it's getting a little clearer, maybe it's getting foggier. I'm not sure which. Well, what's your thoughts here? I mean, Trump, he's getting more and more firmly ensconced by the day, but...
I think it's getting murkier.
Murkier by the day.
Because, I mean, there was a kind of a whole scenario as to how this is going to work. Yeah. They change, repeal and replace Obamacare first, because that has to be done as a budget reconciliation. Then they would do tax cuts. Then they would do infrastructure. And along the way, they'd be doing deregulation of all the different agencies. That was kind of the plan. Healthcare has turned out to be a lot more difficult, not because everybody doesn't agree to repeal it, but how to replace it is very controversial. And even there's a split among the Republicans about how to do that. So that's kind of holding things up, because that's got to get resolved first before you get to all the tax cuts, which is where Wall Street has been so excited to get corporate and individual tax cuts, get a lot of deductions down. And all of that has really been one of the key reasons the stock market's been doing so well since the election. And then you get to infrastructure. Which is more bipartisan. The Democrats like that too. That's the real good stuff, because that spends a lot of money, that creates a lot of jobs, that creates more demand for natural resources. But we're kind of being blocked from getting to the infrastructure and the tax cuts by the healthcare debate. So that's why things are much more in flux now, because it's not going as smoothly as they would have thought.
Well, I mean, this is politics. Look, you know, Jordan, the main product of Washington is what do they make best? Sausage, right?
And you don't like to see the way it's being made, and we're seeing it right now.
It's not a pretty sight. If you ever go to the butcher shop, they don't have the sausage making in the window, right?
No, that's right. But in this case, it is, and it really is important. I mean, the Congressional Budget Office came out with an estimate that 24 million people would lose health insurance in 10 years. 14 million right away. Now, some of that is voluntary. It's not they're being forced off, but because it won't be mandatory anymore to have health insurance, the mandate will go away. A lot of people would decide not to have health insurance. People kind of forget that's the reason a lot of people would drop it. But even so, I think politically it's difficult to have 14 to 24 million people not have health insurance because they either can't afford it or don't want to pay for it. So I think when people go back to their districts, this is going to be a real issue for a lot of people. So that, and this is not what President Trump said. We're going to have great coverage for everyone. He did not say we're going to drop 24 million people. So I think that one's got to be resolved before they come up with a plan that's going to go ahead here.
Yeah, well, I don't know necessarily that the numbers coming out of the CBO are correct. I mean, they said that Obamacare was going to save us billions of dollars, and look what happened there. You know, those numbers, and then the policies that people have under Obamacare, it's really a combination of catastrophic care and self-insurance when you get down to
exactly.
It.
I mean, you pay insurance. More for getting less.
Yeah.
It's one of the few consumer products that they keep raising the price for buying less and less stuff. You've got my deductible this year went from $5,000 to $7,000, and the premium doubled. This is not going to create a lot of consumers being happy when you pay a lot more for getting a lot less, but that's in fact what's happening, because the insurance companies are getting hit so hard by the people who are the new entrants that are using a huge amount of health care, the 20 million or so that have been added in the last few years. They have to pass on the cost to everybody else in the form of higher deductibles, higher co-payments. And so everybody else, the healthy ones, are paying for all the unhealthy ones. And the people paying don't like it. The people receiving the benefits, they think this is great.
Yeah. Oh, it's wonderful. But people that are on Medicaid, they're not happy. You know, nobody's happy. Let's face it.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a major, this is 20% of the economy. I mean, healthcare is really important, not only for the healthcare part of it, but all the jobs and the drug companies and the medical device companies and the hospitals and the insurance companies. These are all big employers. And so you really got to do this right, just to not disrupt literally a fifth of the economy.
You know, Ted Cruz came up with an idea because they wanted to pass this through budget reconciliation because it needs to be a budget reconciliation measure so it doesn't require 60 senators.
Correct.
And Cruz, you know, and that means that the Senate parliamentarian really takes on outsized importance because that person determines whether or not it's a substantive law requiring 60 votes or a budget measure requiring only 51. Mm-hmm. It's crazy rules of the Senate. And Cruz said, hey, if you go back to the Budget Reconciliation Act, I think it was either of 74 or 84, there's a measure in there that says that the vice president can make those decisions, not in lieu of the parliamentarian. And yet McConnell hasn't gone for that. So the fact is, you know, they need to go back to the drawing board here and start this thing over again, because if it doesn't pass, it's definitely going to be a defeat for Trump, but it might actually be a very good thing if it doesn't pass. Right.
Yeah, well, they want to get it right. They've been kind of rushing it through. But what I'm saying is it's infecting the rest of the agenda. And that's why the stock market has been getting kind of wobbly lately. Mm-hmm. Is if it's all this huge rise we've had since the election is all predicated on the tax cuts going through, the infrastructure happening, deregulation happening, all these other things. And if all that stops happening because healthcare is bogging the whole thing down, then that's what's going to make the stock market, which has had a huge move, not on reality, but on expectations, kind of nervous.
Yeah. So, you know, some of this to be expected, right? Unrealistic expectations. Wouldn't you say that
there were a lot of expectations going into this? But in this case, it's not just expectations. People have been putting their money on the line. I mean, we've had an increase in over $3 trillion in market value since the election. That's real money. So it's more than just expectations. People have been, you know, planning accordingly, and they're changing tax policy, and people getting their shovel ready, infrastructure projects ready, and counting on deregulation. I mean, people are acting based on as though this is all going to happen. And if it doesn't, it's going to be a big, big disappointment.
Yeah, well, you know, Trump has a lot of enemies, a lot of people that want him to fail on both sides of the aisle here.
Right.
I mean, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, right?
Well, he's got more enemies than friends at this point. So a lot of people are going to be close to him. I mean, meanwhile, while all this is going on, the Fed Reserve is wanting to slow the economy to some extent. I mean, they raised rates another quarter point. They said they're going to raise them at least another two times, maybe three in 2017. And so think of Trump as putting his foot as hard as possible on the accelerator in the car in all these stimulatory programs, and the Fed pushing its foot on the brake and not super hard, but tapping it on the brake at the same time. And the harder Trump accelerates things, the harder they're going to push on the brake. Mm-hmm. Now, we'll have to see how that works out. It's not a great way to drive a car to have your foot on the accelerator and the brake at the same time.
No. No, that's kind of like a kid learning to drive, right?
Yes, but supposedly they didn't know what they're doing by now. I mean, Yellen, her term is up February 2018, next year. And so Trump would be appointing a new Fed chair probably in September of this year. So they're not the best of friends, but I think he's not going to try to push her out. There's already two seats on the Fed board that he has to appoint people to. So over time, I think the Fed's going to be more accommodative to what Trump wants. But in the meantime, they're going to be raising rates to so-called normalized levels. And what's happening is the banks are raising what they're charging on loans. The prime rate went up to 4% from 3.75%. So that means that checking account, credit cards,
everything is going
student
up.
Student loans, car loans, mortgages, all those things are going up. But what they're paying on deposits is not going up because they can get away with it, so they will. So they're not paying more than 0% basically on CDs and savings accounts and money market funds, and treasury bills are still pretty much at zero. So the consumer gets screwed again. Here's basically what's happening. You pay more, but you don't get to earn anything more.
No wonder people love banks so much, right?
That's right. Well, the bank stocks have done very well because the anticipation is that widening profit margins, net interest margins, will bring them huge more profits without them having to do anything. But I'm just saying from the consumer angle, it's up. And I mean, I do a lot of radio shows, as you know, around the country, and people complain, you know, what am I supposed to do when I've got my money in the bank earning zero? You know, am I going to get higher rates if the Fed keeps raising rates? And I say, no, you're not. You're going to keep getting zero as far as the eye can see. The banks assume people are inert, and they're right. There's something like $10 trillion now sitting in CDs and savings accounts earning nothing, and they don't feel any compunction whatsoever to raise rates to attract money. The banks have loads of money as is, right? They've got plenty of capital, so they feel no compunction to raise deposit rates to bring in more money because they got plenty as it is right now.
Yeah.
When people ask me that, what am I supposed to do? I mean, an answer that I've given them, and I've talked in this show with you before, sure, are these bridge loans that have worked really, really well for people. Commercial mortgage bridge loans is a way of earning 6% over 1 year very safely, get monthly checks, get your money back at the end of the year, no commissions or fees of any kind. So there you go. There's a website for that, commercialmortgagebridgeloans.com. And these are loans to high quality commercial projects that can't get loans from banks. I mean, it's kind of hitting you on both sides. While the banks have all this money, they still really make it difficult for commercial projects to get done because of all the regulations from Dodd-Frank. So this is like the private market filling in the vacuum. It's created that way. So people get their loans from these bridge loans, get their projects done. And meanwhile, you as an investor can get 6% instead of zero, which is pretty good. And if you're willing to go out longer, like 2 years, you can get as much as 8%. So maybe that'll help some of your listeners a bit.
Now, Trump says he wants to get rid of Dodd-Frank, correct?
Well, I don't think get rid of it altogether, but I think slim it down or weaken it to some extent. I mean, there are a lot of things in Dodd-Frank that are good as far as protecting the system. When we hit 2008, the regulators didn't know what to do. They didn't have any tools to deal with the situation. They were kind of doing it all on the fly. Dodd-Frank put in some rules, these so-called systemically important institutions. And I mean, those kind of things I think are going to stay. What I think needs to be weakened are the super tight regulations on lending, because that really has hurt both individuals as far as getting mortgages and businesses as far as getting small business loans. And that's slowed the economy. I think loosening those up to some extent. We don't want to go back to the crazy days of the mid-2000s when you just had to be able to fog a mirror to be able to get a loan. That was too much. But yeah, we've gone too far as I'm concerned, to make it too tight, too difficult for perfectly creditworthy individuals and businesses to get loans. So that's where I think some of the loosening can legitimately happen.
Yeah. And what about like the hard money loans and owner financing, stuff like that?
Well, that's part of the economy. I think that's okay. I mean, also in the loan area, another player here is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has put a huge amount of regulations to make it, again, difficult to get loans in various ways. They are under threat, and that was part of the Dodd-Frank law. They set them up as an independent agency specifically so Congress could not change their budget or kind of oversight them. And now the Republicans are in control and want to get rid of them in many cases. And there was actually a recent court case which said that the way the CFPB was set up in the first place was unconstitutional. And the Trump administration was on the side of the justice, not their own agency. They said, yes, we should rein in the CFPB. I think they've done some good things, but I think, again, there's been too much regulation, which the end result is it makes it hard for people to get mortgages, credit cards, and small business loans.
Yeah, and look, the owner financing thing, I mean, what is wrong with that? I mean,
and
it severely restricted that. And then hard money, all that has done is limiting hard money loans. I mean, it basically eliminated it. Dodd-Frank was increased the number of foreclosures.
Exactly.
There are people.
There's always the unintended consequence of these things. People need loans.
Yeah.
And if they're not going to get them a traditional way, they're going to get them some other way is what happens.
Yeah.
I mean, another example is CFPB. They've clamped down on payday loans, which I think is a good thing. I think those are abusive in many cases. But in many cases, like North Carolina is an example, but pretty much banned payday loans. Okay, so you're in North Carolina and you need a loan to kind of get to the next paycheck. So what are you going to do? So will they borrow from Caribbean islands and Indian reservations?
Indian reservations, yeah.
Right?
Isn't that wonderful?
So because they're not considered under U.S. laws, and you know, you can do it from Bahamas or Panama or something like that, which are complete ripoff. So when you clamp down on something, it doesn't mean the need for the loan has gone away. It means the ability to get it has gone away. So it forces people to do even more extreme kinds of things. So this is the kind of example of how overregulation has unintended consequences.
Yeah, and Harvard University was in on these payday loans too. So right. It was good enough for Harvard to make money at, you know?
A lot of hedge funds and so on, yes. But I mean, I agree it was abusive to people, but absolutely, there are ways of regulating them. You don't have to put them completely out of business, for example. And that's basically the attitude of the CFPB. If they're bad, we want to ban them for everybody.
Yeah. Oh, no, the CFPB was just a horrible agency. And there is nothing that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did that they had jurisdiction over that somebody else didn't have jurisdiction over.
Right.
So they've got concurrent jurisdiction. So you've got multiple agencies passing or having the right to pass regulations over the same industry. It's a recipe for mayhem and confusion and just awfulness.
I know people, for example, in the mortgage business who said that the amount of paperwork that they now have to put people through is just unbelievable. It's just way, way over the top of what it should be. And the documentation, anytime there's any change whatsoever in any of the documents, they've got to get, you know, kind of notarized signatures and everything. It's just that's an example of how it makes it more difficult for the average person to get a mortgage, which slows economic growth. If people can't get mortgages, they can't buy houses. So that's one specific one I know well where they've really overdone it.
Yeah. And we had the HUD one form. Okay.
Yeah.
Or I don't know, since I got my first mortgage in the 80s and it worked fine. All right. You get like a bunch of disclosures and they basically the disclosure says you're borrowing X. And if you keep the mortgage to term, which nobody does in this day and age, you will pay roughly triple the amount of what you're borrowing in interest.
Right.
That's what it was when the rates were so high. Now it's maybe double. And you know, a bunch of other disclosures that nobody reads.
Exactly.
And now they're such geniuses. Richard Cordray, he's such a genius. He's going to come up with 50 pages more of disclosures that no consumer is ever going to read. And as a result, disrupted the entire mortgage industry. Takes much longer to get a mortgage now and to close a loan. And for what? How were people helped by this?
The way they think in Washington is if you disclose it, then the consumer is protected. And by disclosure, they mean, you know, pages and pages of really small type in legal language. So that's in their mind, they've done a great job because all the risks have been disclosed. That doesn't help the average person, which is, as you say, never going to read all this stuff and does not feel protected at all. And this is not only true in the mortgage areas we've just been talking about, but in the investment area as well. I mean, you do a prospectus or something where you're, you know, going through this whole area, you know, you can have a 250-page prospectus with all this legal stuff in there. The average person maybe will read the first page and not go through all this. So disclosure is not the panacea that they think it is in Washington.
Yeah. Well, disclosure should always be done, but like you said, it isn't the be all and the end all. It doesn't necessarily solve the problems, and it isn't going to solve the problem of the ignorant consumer. That's for sure.
Yeah. And people are just overwhelmed by all this stuff. But this has been true in credit cards, in a lot of different areas. But we've said our piece. Disclosure does not solve all. But the Washington people think that, you know, if you disclose it, then the consumer is well-informed and nothing's ever going to go wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got we're at an indecisive point here in the market, in the Trump administration. Is he going to pull a rabbit out of the hat here, Jordan, or what?
I think so in the end. I do think so, because there's the Republicans feel this is their chance. I mean, they've been waiting for this for a long time, and they've got a majority in the House and the Senate. Even though Trump is unpredictable, putting it mildly, I think they have to pull it together, and meaning doing something in healthcare, get to the tax cuts, get to the infrastructure spending, because they realize if they don't do these things that they promised, then it'll be a bloodbath in 2018. So it could be really great if they actually make all these things happen. If they get nothing done, the voters are going to be really mad at them. So it's going to be messy, but I think in the end, they're going to pull this thing through, and we will get the tax cuts, which will stimulate economic growth. We will get the infrastructure programs. Hopefully there are a lot of shovel-ready programs they can actually go out and do, because there's enough stuff falling apart. And deregulation is clearly happening. I mean, everybody that's being put into all these agencies, they're slashing their budgets, laying a lot of people off, rolling back all kinds of regulations, whether it be labor or environmental or financial or energy. I mean, those things are actually happening. So we'll see. But I think they realize they have to. This is their chance and they can't blow it.
Yeah. Hey, just look what's going on with the EPA. They put Pruitt in there, no bigger enemy of the EPA than him. And that's been repeated in other agencies as well.
They're cutting his budget 30%.
Yeah.
You know? So it's not only the guy at the top, but there's going to lay off a lot of the bureaucrats who are putting in all these regulations. And, you know, I'm all for clean air and clean water. I don't want to pollute things, but I think it was getting too extreme and making it difficult for companies to do what they want to do. Companies don't want to pollute. You know, they want it to be relatively clean, but the regulation was so extreme and the benefit was so little for the huge amount of cost that I think that's not a bad thing to roll some of that back.
Yeah. Yeah. I think and you're looking at coal is making a resurgence now. That's coming back. And yeah. Hey, it's going to get
deregulation is good. We've had a huge amount of regulation increase in the last 8 years or so, huge in every area. And it's stifled growth and stifled jobs, and getting some of that off the back of people, I think, is going to make a big difference. So, and that a lot of that can be done by executive order and by the people running these agencies. So, I mean, it's already starting to happen to some extent, and you're seeing companies bringing factories back here or deciding not to go overseas because of the deregulatory situation. I mean, just one example in the car industry, they were talking about, I think, 54 miles a gallon as a goal, which is pretty extreme, and they're going to roll that back to some extent. I mean, we're still gaining gas mileage all the time, but not at the extreme level it was, and that's going to keep jobs in the U.S. in manufacturing here. Mm-hmm. So there's just a whole bunch of examples of that, and you just don't want it to be too extreme, and I think it was getting too extreme.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think this type of thing is normal. This uncertainty and this kind of stall in a new administration. So we'll just have to see what happens. Anyway, Jordan, people want to find out about the bridge loans. Where's the best place to go?
So my website is moneyanswers.com. I get emails from your folks all the time. I'm glad to help them. I've got lots of videos and links and resources. I take emails directly. Love to help people in any area of personal finance they may have questions about. And the bridge loans is just one example where they can earn 6% instead of earning 0 on their money. And there's just lots of other resources around that hopefully can help your listeners.
All right. And if you got any questions, comments on this show or others, just send us an email, kl@carrylutz.com. That's kl@carrylutz.com. The Twitter feed is @CarrieLutz. The Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. Jordan, we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks so much, Carrie. Appreciate it.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to FinancialSurvivalNetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.